Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. At this stage of this year's rains retreat, having spent 1 week already of the rains retreat, it's a good time to really start describing the preliminary supports for success in samatha, the grounds by which once developed will give rise to jhana, which will give rise to that powerful state of mind of full concentration. Sometimes that when, as a monk, one aspires for these states, it really helps to be able to build solid foundations, first of all, because without those foundations one will find great difficulty in attaining any of these states. And when one finds difficulty in attaining one of these states, one feels that it's because one is not trying hard enough, or one hasn't quite got the right way, or not the right place. And sometimes that one will give in through frustration, feeling it's not possible, or it's not possible for oneself, and miss the great opportunity for experiencing what these states are. And so it is useful at this time, the beginning of the rains retreat, to point out some of the basic requirements so that things like jhana can actually occur, so that when you do put forth the effort and you do aspire for these things, that you attain them. Just in my experience as a monk, that I can really point out like two things which jhanas depend upon. You know, one of them is just like effort, the force of the mind, the energy of the mind, the ability to actually point that effort and sustain that effort in the right place. And the other thing which is very useful is the wisdom element, the understanding of the Dhamma. Because these two are the ways into jhanas. It's always sort of struck me that why it was that a person who attains path and fruit, who attains one of the stages on the path, finds it ever easier to enter a jhana. Up to the point where an anagami, a non-returner, has great ease in entering jhana. And of course an arahat has no problem whatsoever entering jhana and abiding therein. And it becomes quite clear after a little bit of reflection, after a little bit of understanding, a little bit of experience, that the way into jhana, depending upon wisdom, is perhaps the most powerful and effective. And sometimes the reason we find difficulty in attaining such states is because a lack of full understanding of what the Buddha was teaching. One of the little quotes from the suttas which always struck me, and which I've mentioned to a few people, is that I think it's in the, I can't remember now, Anguttara or the Sanghita, where the Buddha is explaining the samadindriya, the samadhi faculty, if you like. And he described it as saying that a monk who develops the, what he called the vosagga aramana, or the mind which takes it as its object or its theme, its main like colour of the mind, being renunciation, giving up, this word Vaisagya, finds it very easy to gain samadhi, finds it very easy to gain one-pointedness of mind. And being one, like being all of you, who wants the easy way into samadhi, the easy way into jhanas, this the Buddha was saying was one of those easy ways. To be able to maintain a mind which has this Vaisagya state most of the time, this state of renunciation, this state of giving up, this state of abandoning. And so it's good to actually understand what it is that one is abandoning, what it is that one is relinquishing, and what this Vaisagya state really means. And quite frankly, what it's really relinquishing is the world of the five senses, what in Pali we call the karma loka, the K long A M A world. This is like the world of sensuality, the world where we spend most of our time, the world where we spend most of our thinking, in the world outside, the world which we perceive with our eyes, hear with our ears, smell with our nose, taste with our tongue, and feel with our body. And sometimes you can ask yourself, how much time do you spend on these things? You know, worrying about the feelings in the body, the aches, the pains, even the sicknesses. You know, worrying about the sounds, too much noise, not enough sound, or whatever it is, not enough Dhamma teachings. About the tastes of food, about the sights, things you like to see in a monastery, things you don't like to see in a monastery. All of this busyness of the mind connected with the five senses is called karma loka. And it's that interest, infatuation, obsession with that world which is that which we need to renounce if we're going to have the Vaisagya Aramana, the state of mind of renunciation. We've got to turn away from that, let it go, leave it alone, not be interested in it, not be worried about it, and to deliberately even not think about it. Because that is the world which actually stops us getting this experience called jhanas. It is the world of busyness, external activity. And sometimes we call it external activity, but a lot of that external activity is managed, planned, thought about inside. It's as if we take the world outside into our minds. And the reason why we think about it is because a lot of it is delightful. And that which is delightful tends to create what we call karma raga, the desire, the lust, the greed, the infatuation with the karma loka, with the world of the five senses. And it is a very insidious sort of trap for the human being. A man sees a beautiful woman, a woman sees a powerful man. You see beautiful food, you see attractive sights, you see TV, you see a newspaper. These things can attract you, pull you. And if the mind isn't very careful, one tends to seek these things out. Actually seeks beautiful sights, seeks beautiful sounds. And this seeking, this karma raga, this desire based on the five sensory realm is the hindrance which we have to give up if we want to enter jhana. So how do you actually give up this very sticky world of the five senses, which quite often just keeps us or leads us around like a person leads a dog on a leash, or leads a bull with a ring through the nose? And the only way we can overcome this is by seeing through that delight and that attraction for the karma loka. Seeing through that which is pleasurable in the karma loka, and seeing that that which is pleasurable is only just part, it is just one side of all of the things which abide in the sensory world. All that abides in the sensory world does have the delicious side to it. It has the beautiful side to it. A nice meal tastes delicious, then it gives you a stomachache afterwards. Or it's nice today, and when you don't get it tomorrow, it's a problem. Beautiful people, you like them at first, and then you get upset about them afterwards. The way we look at others is always going to be changing. And if the way we look at them doesn't change, that they change. People get old, people get sick. And the most beautiful woman ends up quite ugly. And the most strong and powerful man ends up weak. And all that which we desire, which we want, which attracts us, because it is always changing, it's not changing for the better usually, it's changing for the worse. It should give us enough clues, enough pointers, so that we really know this karma loka properly. And so we do not expect any delight in it. So we do not even look for satisfaction in it. And we know the dangers in it, which is perhaps most important. Once you know the dangers in the karma loka, you regard the karma loka, like the Buddha taught, like a little worm on the end of a hook for a fish. It looks very beautiful, it looks delicious, and so the fish goes along and takes that bait. And because it takes that bait, it comes to great pain, death, destruction, or captivity, once it's taken that bait. And you have to know that inside of that bait, you know, hidden somewhere inside that little worm on the end is a hook. And because you take that hook, it's going to cause a lot of problems and trouble for you. It's dangerous, this karma loka. If you ever start to get desire for food, you're going to suffer as a result. You're going to become worried and concerned what people put out in the morning for breakfast, or what they put out for lunch. And I've known many monks in the past to have tried to arrange and manipulate to get this particular food they like and that particular food they like, making suggestions. And a couple of years ago, there was one Anagarika staying here who liked oily food. And every day, even when he wasn't on the cooking roster, he would go into the kitchen at 10:25, get out a can of oil, and pour the oil over the rice, pour the oil over the curries. I don't think he poured the oil over the fruit, but he just poured the oil over everything he could pour it on. Because he liked oil, he liked oily food. And sooner or later you just can't stay in a place like a monastery if you try things like that, or if you try and arrange and manipulate to get exactly what you want in the world of the five senses. You find, whether it's in a monastery or whether you're living by yourself or wherever you are, you find you always end up getting frustrated. This world of the five senses will never satisfy you. You will never sort of find satisfaction in a newspaper, you never find satisfaction in a nice meal, you never find satisfaction in company, having a nice chat, you never find satisfaction in a cup of tea, you never find satisfaction in a glass of Milo, or in the morning, or in the breakfast, or whatever else which you want. In fact, you usually find out the more you want, the more you're opening yourself up for suffering. The more that you want, the more vulnerable you are. The more vulnerable you are to that which you want being taken away from you, or being deprived of that which you want. The less you want, the less you need in this world, you find the less chance there is of disappointment. That's why the Buddha always encouraged monks to be apicca, monks of few desires, easy to look after. If you have few desires, few things you need to survive, then you find that you don't have much to think about. You don't have much to plan, to arrange, to manipulate, to ask your parents for, to ask people who give you invitation for. That you can live quite peacefully without having to worry and be concerned about all that stuff. And if it doesn't come, you're still very much at peace. You're a person who has few needs in this world. And having few needs is perhaps one of the first ways of overcoming this dependence on karma loka. You know, okay, sometimes, you know, there are some requirements to keep the body healthy, but you can also train the body to be strong. You don't train the body to be strong by giving in to its whims. And sometimes it's good to go against the comforts which the body always demands, and to push the body a bit more. Obviously within limits, but one can do a lot of pushing. I mean, for those of us who have had the great fortune to be with Ajahn Chah, you notice how much he would push people to endure discomfort and to overcome discomfort, not to worry about it. He called it toraman, which literally means torture, and that was, you know, a great part of his practice, and it's something which he really encouraged. It certainly did toughen up many of the monks, but he had the nerve to do things like that. I really haven't. Many of you are bigger than me. But perhaps the best way of overcoming this karma loka, this attachment, this interest, this infatuation and association with the five sensory realm, is to develop this quality, which is, I keep on saying this, one of the most important qualities in the Buddha's teachings, called nibbida. There's like that wish to really be released from samsara, this aversion to existence. And take aversion to existence very carefully, because it is that which sees the danger of the five sensory realm so much that it's not being equanimous with it, not being indifferent to it, but having that realization this is something which is unpleasant, which is dangerous, which is something which needs to be avoided. And we're going to avoid it. Just reading the other day about the Buddha talking about samsara, saying these old similes, but they're very powerful similes, they were to me anyway, that through the so many rounds of rebirth which we've all been through, if you look in the perspective of hundreds, thousands, millions of lives, aren't we fed up yet? We're going through the same old process again and again and again, trying to find satisfaction, trying to find fulfillment, trying to find perfect relationship, trying to find some sort of happiness, comfort, wealth, find the perfect house, the perfect beach, the perfect country, the perfect climate, the perfect food, trying to get ourselves really well set up, and then finding it all decays, gets taken away from us. If not before, at least at the time of death. When you look at the cycle of rebirth and look at its main characteristics, which are birth, old age, decay and death, when you look at those main characteristics of each life on the wheel, the Buddha said, isn't it about time we got fed up with this? We get sort of not bored with it, but just, I've had enough of this. And that's why the Buddha used the word nibbindati. It's enough to get nibbida towards this cycle of existence. And it's this nibbida towards especially the karma loka, not equanimity to it, that's not enough, but actually distaste for the delight of the senses. It's the way that Venerable Sariputta used this word. He said it's like a young man or a young woman who likes to go out at night, who likes to dress up, wear makeup, finds himself wearing the dead carcass of a snake. then having sort of washed themselves, adorned themselves, brushed their hair, put scent, put perfume, deodorant, put on their best clothes, if suddenly they found themselves wearing the carcass of a dead snake, rotting, dripping with, you know, ooze and maggots and stuff, now would you be equanimous towards that? Would they just say, oh, there's just a nice snake here, look, it's oozing, it's dripping, don't be attached, just be mindful? They get disgusted with it. They have aversion towards it. They want to get rid of it. They want to sort of take it off and throw it away, wash themselves again and get rid of every trace of that rotting carcass of a snake around their necks. And in the same way, is that feeling which they have towards that rotting carcass is nibbida. And this is the same word which the Buddha used as a wise monk or a wise nun or a wise lay person who has seen the Dhamma has towards the world of the five senses, and also the world of the six senses as well, but at least the world of the five senses. And it's only if we have that, see the danger, see the problem, see the associated pain in karma loka clearly enough, that we'll get nibbida. And once we get the nibbida, this will what will be able to cut off the infatuation with karma loka, with the world of the five senses. Otherwise, when we're sitting, we'll think, we'll worry about the aches and pains in our body, we'll worry about the books we're writing, we'll worry about the letters we have to send, we worry about where we're going to go to after the retreat is over. We worry over the buildings, we worry over this, because we're infatuated, obsessed, concerned with the world of the five senses. I know that many of you have been quite rightly concerned about the tendency of many monks to be obsessed with building and infatuating with building. Building monasteries, building Buddhist societies, building up great institutions and edifices and getting praise thereby, thinking, what a great monastery you've got, you know, it looks really beautiful, or what a great Buddhist center you have, just so many people go there. And it's true, that's not the point of the practice of Buddhism. We do that just as a duty, just as an external. But there's many other types of building which we do, which are also just building up problems in the karma loka. Now the worrying about places to go, planning trips, thinking about sort of finding just the perfect monastery, the perfect cave, the beautiful place which is just the right weather. This again is just the interest, the association, the obsession with the karma loka again. Talking with people, chatting and enjoying the pleasure of company, again is the pleasure of the five senses. Worrying about food, again, pleasure of the five senses. So the only way to overcome this is by realizing the danger in all of this, the burden of all of this, the busyness. You are messing up your minds for no reason. There's no cause to do this. It's not necessary. And you notice this, like in a place like this during the rains retreat. Just, I mean, as I've been here longer than anyone and really tried hard to set this monastery up so that many monks don't need to do anything whatsoever, just a few modest duties, looking after a storeroom or just cleaning up the hall. Just the amount of external business to be done is like minimal. And usually the first week or two that monks are very good, and anagarikas are very good, they don't come close to the kitchen, they don't look for distractions. But as the rains retreat wears on, you find out that just old habits die hard, and you tend to find more people like looking for one another to have conversations, or finding things to do, finding jobs to do. There's another Anagarika who was here a couple of years ago. Now he came here and he said, I really want, you know, to develop jhanas. You know, like, can you teach me? And I told him quite straight that you can develop jhanas here. But you know, you've got to sort of put forth the time and effort for it. And after 1 or 2 weeks of that putting forth effort, he spent the rest of the range retreat up in the library, just reading books, studying Pali, translating. And I've just heard that now he's done another Pali course over in the ANU in Canberra, and now he's gone off to Nalanda in India to do some more Pali studies. He's probably going to be a brilliant in Pali, but he's, you know, missing the point. He had this marvellous opportunity here to just leave that aside just for 3 months, to really develop that wasagga, the renunciation of the karma loka, for 3 months, and just put all of the attention, all of the effort, all of the time on just renouncing that. So when one knows how to renounce the karma loka, and when one renounces out of nibbida, out of aversion for it, it's as if you want just to turn the switch and turn all this off. Turn off the world of the five senses. And that's what one does in jhana. Turns off the world of the five external senses and just concentrates and puts one's mind on the sixth sense. And that's why that if one can develop that wasagga state of mind of renouncing this world of the five senses, not being interested in it, in fact being averse to it, averse to not just building monasteries but talking, being averse to sort of having to go down and eat, being averse to being around other people, being being averse to having to have so many things in your heart, being averse to having to be a slave to the feelings of your body. So much so you say, body, you look after yourself. You know, if you feel cold, tough luck, I'm going to sit and just forget about you. If I feel sick, I've got stomachache, tough luck, I'm not going to be concerned about you. I'm going to watch my breath. And having that sort of, that aversion which can turn off this concern for the five sensory world, you'll find will make it very much easier for you to gain things like jhana. And especially if, again, if that aversion is fueled by as much nibbida as you can arouse. And of course, I mean, that nibbida, that level of nibbida, comes with path and fruition. And that's why that someone who's Arya finds it much easier to enter samadhi, because their nibbida is very strong. And that nibbida being so strong, it just cuts away the interest, infatuation with the five sensory world. And if you can cut off the five senses, all that's left is just the clear path into jhanas. That's why, I mean, they say that, you know, the jhanas are the eradication of the five hindrances, and the pointing of the mind then onto one object, and because the five hindrances are eradicated, the mind can stay on that thing very easily. And the first hindrance, as you know, you all should know, is karma chanda, which is, you know, that will, that intention caught up with the karma realm, with the world of the five senses. And it's not just desire, it's the whole interest, the whole concern with the world of the five senses. That's a problem. And so one has to be like disconcerned in order to overcome that hindrance. But sometimes people say one should practice asupa. You know, this practice or this meditation on the loathsomeness aspect. But you know, asupa is a very wide word, and you don't really just need to do it towards body. That's only if like body is concerned. You do it like asupa just to all of the five senses. that just seeing that there can never be just any sort of purity of sound or purity of taste or purity of feeling or purity purity of touch. That, you know, in the end it is it all impure. So then it comes and it goes. It's happy one moment, it's painful the next. And it's just a great mess. It's not brilliant, it's not pure. Like the other word of supa is this brilliance, this shiningness. And this is not what the five sensory world is. So the more one can contemplate that and dissociate with from that, the more one is overcoming that first hindrance, which is one of the most powerful. That's why it's number one of the hindrances to overcome. Of course, the other hindrances also need to be overcome. Why apada or ill will is quite often explained as just the frustration of karma chanda, the frustration of the desire caught up with the five senses, which gives rise to ill will. Udicca kukkaccha is again just the worry and concern, usually again caught up with the five senses. So if one can overcome karma, then one has a marvellous chance of entering jhana very easily, very quickly. So knowing this, the wasagga states of mind make it very easy to enter jhana. Perhaps we can start to develop this aversion towards the sensory world. And indeed, the more one can develop this, the more one is practicing what the Buddha taught. Again, one of my favorite quotes of the Buddha was his very brief teaching to Venerable Upali. You may know that Venerable Upali was a Vinaya expert. Venerable Upali wanted to go off into the forest to train in meditation. The Buddha would not allow him at first until he mastered the Vinaya, knowing that Venerable Upali would have the ability later on to become an arahat. But before he actually did that, he wanted him to learn the Vinaya first of all for the sake of the other monks. And so he learnt the Vinaya and he became the expert next to the Buddha in the rules for the monastic communities. And then when he wanted to go off into the forest and the Buddha allowed him, he asked for a little teaching from the Buddha, a teaching in brief. And what the Buddha taught him was, Venerable Upali, whatever teaching, whatever practice leads completely to nibbida, this like aversion, nibbida, which leads to viraga, the cutting off of raga, of desire, lust, which leads to nirodha, cessation, upasamaya, calm, abhinyaya, knowledge. So nirodha was the next one, cessation, and nibbana. So whatever practice leads to these things, you should know for sure, Venerable Upali, that this is the Dhamma of the Buddha, this is the Vinaya of the Buddha, this is the teaching of the teacher. And I always like that little phrase, because it really showed you that what this Dhamma, what this practice, what this Vinaya is that which leads to Nibbida, that which leads to Viraga, that which leads to, you know, Upasama, calm, that which leads to wisdom, abhinya, that which leads to cessation, that which leads to nibbana, nibbana, the going out of the flame. Once you understand that, once one understands that very clearly, one knows exactly what one should be doing. And these are the things which lead to wisdom, which lead to jhanas. And so one should look, what am I doing? Is it leading to nibbida, turning away? Is it leading to dispassion? Is it leading to calm? Is it leading to wisdom? Is it leading to cessation and nibbana or not? then seeing that, one can start to cut out a lot of things in one's mind, the way one thinks, the way one uses one's mind, the way one uses one's speech, the way one uses one's body. Because one knows it's not going to lead to these things. So one has to stop this. One has the opportunity to develop these marvelous states of mind, but one has to have the will, the intent, the desire to do so. And so it's a great opportunity to develop jhanas. This is a way of doing it. Cutting off the karma realm. The other way of developing jhanas, which is also important to mention as the prerequisite, is looking at the development of jhanas from terms of the old gradual practice, the gradual path, which the Buddha taught also many, many times. And he was sort of saying again and again that first of all one has to practice sila, and then from sila one can go to sense restraint. Only once sense restraint is well founded could one hope to do sati sampajanya, with mindfulness and clear comprehension, and once that is well founded one can practice samadhi. And that is a very powerful teaching, because again, if one is having trouble developing samadhi, then it is always worthwhile going back and seeing if these causes are weak, see whether there needs to be any work done, not on samadhi but on the causes for samadhi. So one looks at one's practice of virtue and see, is there anything one can do to improve on virtue? And that virtue also includes, you know, what we call here korwat, which is the rules of the monastery, the rules of deportment, the monastic etiquette, which Ajahn Yanadamo is teaching on Tuesday mornings. And that's why this is a very important part of the practice of meditation. And it's why the forest teachers make such a big deal about it. They don't do it just, you know, to make a show to other people visiting the monastery, look how well restrained and well behaved these monks are. Because, you know, these forest teachers in Thailand, I mean, they're extremely wise and sharp, and they don't do things for nothing. So if they make such a big fuss and bother about core what, there must be something in it. And what's in it is it's just a basic virtue in the monastery. And the next thing which one has to look at is one's sense restraint, the restraint of the five senses and the sixth sense as well, mind. And does one go out looking for distractions? Does one go out looking for people to talk to? Does one go out looking for people to teach? Does one go looking for any papers in the fire room to read? Or any sort of interesting novels up in the library? And if one does, it means one isn't restraining the senses. That restraining of the senses takes work, it takes effort. And you don't restrain the senses by letting them go. Restraining the senses means saying no to the habit of the mind, always to go out and seek for pleasure, or to, through ill will, trying to overcome obstacles which you think are blocking your pleasure. And sense restraint also comes with eating food. And not always just to put the food in your bowl which you like. Venerable Mahamoggallana used to have the following practice. If in the morning he thought of a particular food he'd like to eat, if he received that food that day, he would not eat it. It's a marvellous practice of sense restraint, isn't it? If he thought of like a piece of bread and jam in the morning, then if he got that during his meal, that he would just not take it, he would take something else. And it's a marvellous practice. If you want to develop jhanas, it's a practice which can be recommended. It stops you thinking about food. sense restraint means not, you know, trying to get that which is pleasurable or beautiful, not being concerned about it. You just eat what's there. And sense restraint, if not practiced, means that you will not be able to say no to that force in the mind which takes it away from its object, that which makes the mind wander. If you can't restrain the senses when they're coarse, you won't be able to restrain the senses when they're fine, practicing meditation. That's why that restraint of the five senses, the indriya samvara, has to come before. So restraint of the six senses has to come before mindfulness and clear comprehension, and then samadhi. So again, one looks, can one restrain the senses more? Can one like pull in the senses like a tortoise pulls in its limbs? Pulling things in and keeping things inside, looking inside, dwelling inside, being like an island unto oneself, spending time in one's heart, you know, withdrawing in even physically and mentally. If one can do that, then one has understood what sense restraint is. It's hard at first because the mind will rebel. It will want to go out and play, and you'll say, no, it can't stay. I'm not going to give you anything to delight in, except the delight in peacefulness and quietness in the mind. This is like called training the mind. Again, I was very impressed in the Dhammapada with that young novice who saw someone making arrows, and the wood, I think probably bamboo, because we've done this before in Thailand, when bamboo is bent, in order to straighten it out, you heat it over a fire, you bend it straight while it's hot, and then you allow it to cool, keeping it straight, and it remains straight afterwards. You've actually straightened the arrow. And a little novice saw this, I think he was only 7 years old. And then he also saw some farmers digging irrigation channels, so they can lead the water from these lakes or big irrigation tanks, reservoirs, to their fields, wherever they wish to do so. And he thought to himself that just as archers like bend the wood to make arrows, just like farmers irrigate their fields, and the other thing he saw was someone training an elephant. Just as like trainers can train an elephant so the elephant can do what they want, why can't I train my mind? And it does need training. You don't sort of train an elephant for equanimity. You don't sort of irrigate the field just by sitting there and hoping the water will go the way it goes. You don't straighten an arrow just by leaving alone and hoping somehow or another it will make its way straight. It needs to be trained, it needs to be done, and training is hard work. Training means like resisting, saying no. But the more one trains the mind, the more stronger one becomes, and the more useful one's mind is. That's why that it's one cannot praise enough those people who have trained their mind better than the victory over 1,000 men, wasn't it? There's the man who can train his own mind and conquer his own mind, or the woman who can do so. And so that we have to train the mind to practice sense restraint. It's not easy, but we do so hopefully out of faith and hopefully out of some experience of knowing what it's like when we just pull our senses in. We don't go around looking for things to disturb us. And then we can find that mindfulness and clear comprehension are able to be developed. The mindfulness of knowing what's going on, clear comprehending of knowing its purpose, knowing its danger, seeing if what you're doing is going to fulfill the task you have. The sampajanya is nearly always goes with sati if it's going to be a wholesome quality. It's not just knowing what's going on, it's having that wisdom element which knows that whether what you're doing is going to fulfill the purpose or not. If it's not going to fulfill the purpose, then you stop and do something else. You restrain the mind, you say no. When we have these abilities, You know, we practice very good virtue, very good kawat. We've developed sense restraint during the day, and we've developed mindfulness and clear comprehension. Then you will find when you sit down, cross your legs, back straight, setting up awareness in front of you and start watching the breath, it's easy. You can watch the breath. You don't miss it. You have sense restraint. You have mindfulness and clear comprehension. And you can follow that breath. And when you follow that breath, letting go further of the sensory world, when karma chanda disappears, then the mental nimitta of the breath appears very clearly, full of piti sukha, and the mind goes towards that, then you enter jhana. And if you can just enter jhana at the end of this retreat, or before, or in the middle, or whenever, at least once, twice, three times, what a marvelous retreat this will be. It will be something which many monks have wanted to experience for many, many years. They read about in books, some people say don't even try, some people say it's impossible, some people say this and that, but it is possible and you should try. And if you try, I don't see why you shouldn't succeed. And hopefully that some of the things which I've said can illustrate and point out where some effort might be placed to create the conditions, to make the foundations, so that jhana can arise. If jhana hasn't arisen yet, maybe I can ask you to contemplate some of these prerequisites. Maybe some work can be done on them. And hopefully, by so doing, you can experience the joy and the bliss of jhana states. Let's see, enough for this evening. Are there any questions about some of the things I've said in my talk? Any questions or comments? They come up. I haven't seen the words being used together. Nekam is just general renunciation. Wosaga literally means like giving up, renouncing. I don't know if they're used precisely in the same context. I think Nekam, if I can remember clearly, is usually used in the sense of like giving up like worldly things. It's more of a coarse giving up. I just like, you know, giving up husband, giving up wife, giving up your house. Whereas I think Wosaga is more like a more refined inner giving up. They may be synonymous. I'm just recording how they're used in the Tipitaka. But certainly, I mean, Nekam, I think this is just a way of use. I think Nekam is usually used, someone can correct me maybe, is giving up things. From what I understand of the use of Wosaga, and certainly its implications through that little quote which I gave of someone who develops Wosaga Ramana will enter Samadhi and Ekagata, which means jhana, very easily. Obviously refers to the giving up of the five senses, or giving up the concern with the five senses. So that Wosaga would mean like a renunciation of like the five sensory realm. Nekam are just renunciation of material things. Does that make sense to you? Have you read it that way in the text? Yeah, that's true, and that's the opposite of moha, isn't it? Lopa. Alopa. You're asking about just re-recording or just emphasizing the sequence involving Nibbida, the full sequence, you know, from the Upanishad Sutta, or the important part of that sequence. So maybe just starting at Samadhi. Is that Samadhi is the cause for the arising of Yathabhuta Jnana Dasana, seeing things as they really are. And seeing things as they really are is the cause for the arising of Nibbida. And I made a point of saying or illustrating that Nibbida is not equanimity, it is not dispassion, it is a much more powerful, forceful quality of actually aversion towards samsara, aversion towards the sensory world. And that is the cause that gives rise to viraga. And viraga is dispassion. And viraga gives rise to vimutti, or freedom, liberation. And then vimutti gives rise to the knowledge of liberation, the summation, the summit of the path of arahat. So that is like the sequence which is found in the Upanishad Sutta, and it's also found in many other places in the Tripitaka, and which shows actually the importance of each one of these terms. And if it really is Yathabhuta Jnana Dasana, the knowledge and vision of things as they really are, it should give rise to Nibbida. And I would say that what one thinks is Yathabhuta Jnana Dasana doesn't give rise to Nibbida, then it's not real true Yathabhuta Jnana Dasana. If one really saw samsara as it really was, saw the sensory world as it really was, understood dukkha in terms of the Four Noble Truths as it really was, then Nibbida would have to be the automatic result. Does that, what you're asking? Is there any other questions on or comments on this talk this evening? Okay, we'll end the talk here then.